Columbia, I've seen your mountains high, seen your pretty rainbows and your blue crystal skies, watched your winding rivers as they flow around the bend. To me, you're not a stranger, you'll always be a friend.
Coming to you from the West Coast, this is Politicoast. Today is July 26, 2018, and this is episode 96. Politicoast is the BC Politics Podcast. If you haven't already, make sure to subscribe, leave a review wherever you found us, and follow us on Facebook and Twitter, where we're at Politicoast Pod. And finally, support the show at patreon.com/politicoast.
I'm Strat Limeboom.
And I'm Ian Bushfield. On today's quieter episode, we're going to talk about the Premier's meeting and guns. But first, we have to thank our Premier sponsors, Lindsay Tedds and Blake Hodson, for helping make the show possible. Politicoast is in partnership with BC Today, the daily newsletter dedicated exclusively to BC politics. Sign up for a free trial to have unique coverage of the BC legislature delivered to your inbox every morning. Listeners to Politicoast, enter the offer code CITIZEN for a special rate just for you. For your free two-week trial of the newsletter, go to britishcolumbiatoday.ca. And as we mentioned last week, we're still getting some feedback for what we should do for episode 100 that's coming up in a few weeks.
We launched a Twitter poll as well as a Facebook poll for which city we should go to.
Vancouver took an early lead and then Victoria caught up, but both of them are in the very low numbers, like 10 or 30. I think I actually set them to probably expire by the time this episode goes live, so we may have to
start a new poll,
re-poll them or do something else. But when 12 people say go to Vancouver and 14 people say go to Victoria, it's hard to make a decision because we want to make sure we have a full room wherever we go. Hopefully by next week, so that we have some time to let you know what's going on, we'll have figured stuff out. But if you have good ideas, if you have a great venue, if you just want to sponsor us to come to your town, someone suggested Fort Langley, probably not doing that, but if you can, you know, churn up 50 people to the old fort, I think we'll do it. So email us podcast@politicoast.ca with whatever ideas you have, or tweet at us. Well, let's do a podcast. Let's talk about the Premier's meeting. This is the annual meeting of the, what do they call themselves? The like
First Ministers?
Oh, there's the First Ministers.
Council
of the Federation. Canada's Premiers.ca, which, who knew that the Premiers needed their own website? But, you know, they have a nice little website there for their meeting that was in St. Andrews, New Brunswick. They get together every year to basically try to present a united front against Ottawa, I guess. And I think that got harder for them this year because there's been a little bit of turnover.
Yeah, so newly elected Premier Doug Ford, as well as recently be appointed if you win a leadership.
He's elected by members.
Yeah, technically lieutenant governor appoints. Anyway, Scott Moe is also there, is what we're getting to. As well as this is John Horgan's first time going to one of these.
Yeah, he missed last year's because there was a little bit of a transition happening at the time. And I think he just won the confidence vote, but needed to put a government together, deal with wildfires, all kinds of stuff was going. And the other new guy there, Joe Savikatak of Nunavut, he's the new premier there after he was elected by his fellow MLAs following the previous premier, Paul Kwasa, losing a confidence vote. Kwasa had been premier since November when they had their last election. I think I knew that Nunavut doesn't have a party system and they try to operate under a consensus Indigenous-inspired model. But the BC tie-in here is for the first, was it like 30 years after the province was formed until like the early 20th century, we had no political parties and just like MLAs just picked who among them would be premier. And it seemed like back then we had a premier every year.
Yeah, we had some interesting characters become premier.
Amorta Cosmos is one I want to get into
at some
point.
Yes, that was the one I was thinking of specifically.
It's the only one anyone remembers. But the Nunavut Parliament does seem like it operates a little bit more stably. Savikatak is only the fifth premier of Nunavut since they joined Confederation in, I think, about 1999.
It's 1990 when the Northwest Territories was cleaved in two.
So I think I'd have to double check for sure, but I think that's about the turnover that Alberta has had in terms of premiers in the same time. So they're doing something right despite their system. But this could also be the last premier's meeting for Rachel Notley, speaking of Alberta, since she's widely expected to lose badly in the spring. And Quebec Premier Philippe Couillard is also facing a tough re-election campaign this October.
Yeah, I haven't followed Tibet politics too much, but the opposition parties don't seem particularly well set up, but who knows what that's going to be like when the rubber hits the road of the campaign.
The CAC is polling well, but, you know, they've blown election campaigns before, I think. So we'll have to see. Also, if anyone but the Quebec Liberals win, they've all made a pact to implement electoral reform without even a referendum. They're just going to do it. So Quebec could beat BC to electoral reform, which would be random. But we were going to actually talk about this meeting that they had. Premier's meetings gets criticized for being dull and not generally producing much, because you generally have, you know, people from across the spectrum, a few liberals, a few conservatives, a couple new Democrats. And that's exactly what you have this year. In fact, you have a couple conservatives who've displaced liberals recently, and trying to get a consensus out of that group doesn't tend to be easy, especially when some of those people are at war with each other, like Alberta and BC. But try as they will, they did manage to put out a consensus statement, a final communique, covering all kinds of grounds, where a lot of it is just, we talked about this. We agree it's important.
Yeah, and a bunch of the stuff is things that have been in the background for a while, or in the Canada's internal free trade agreement, which, yet again, I need to point out how dumb it is that a country has to sign its own internal free trade agreements. But stuff like transportation regulations are a complete mismatch across the country, and they're saying they made a little progress on it, but, you know, it's still a lot of work to do.
My favorite example in here is how our health and safety rules are so different across the country that if you're a company that has offices across Canada, you might have to buy up to 10 different kinds of first aid kits for your offices in different cities, just because the rules are slightly different. And they're agreeing that that is dumb. And since a first aid kit is basically a first aid kit, we could probably standardize that rule without, you know, any threat to occupational health and safety. So 2018, slowly getting to some common sense. But you see some of the disagreement in the language around, like, pharmacare, for example. They all talk about how, you know, pharmacare is a great idea, they're all on board, except participation by provinces and territories must be voluntary. So they like the idea, especially if Ottawa gives a bunch of money for it, but they also just want to be able to opt out.
Yeah, I can't imagine Doug Ford is particularly keen on this sort of program. Not when he has a bunch of money he has to cut.
Well, it's actually Quebec who
pledged to cut.
I was thinking it would be Doug Ford or Scott Moe, but it was actually Quebec whose name specifically saying they intend to do their own thing.
Of course they do, because everything in Quebec has to be unique.
So that one already has the big caveat on it. They talk about addictions and mental health, saying they just want more money from the federal government, but they're going to keep working on it. Healthy aging and healthcare procurement are the same kind of things. They're going to try to work across the country to buy new MRI machines and things like that. I think the most detailed policy in here is on the legalization of cannabis, where they all came together and agreed a number of bullet points that they're like, we don't know what's going on here yet, Ottawa. We have like a month and a half, 2 months. Come on, get on it. And that one makes sense, because that's mostly Ottawa pushing through the legislation while the provinces are trying to catch up.
Yeah, well, the legislation is through now, but there's some of the regulatory details still have to be sorted out.
The other big win, I think, is on Greyhound services, but it's not really so much as a win as they all agreed that Greyhound canceling buses across the West, as we talked about last week, is a bad thing and worrying, and the federal government should step up and give more money. It's a common theme.
Yeah, in fact, that is a theme I expect to see repeated at the First Minister's Conference, whenever the next one of that is, because that's basically how they always turn out, is the provinces go to the Prime Minister and say, hey, we could use a lot more money for all of these things. And the Prime Minister invariably says, we actually don't have that much money to give you. And it's one of the reasons those meetings aren't too productive, and why Harper stopped going to them.
And we'll get into this in our next segment, but one of the other things they talk about is getting the federal government to step up on addressing crime rates, and they're all going to work together. And of course, the federal government should continue collaboration. And it's just so many buzzwords. It's hard to actually read these things and figure out what they actually did. I was listening to CBC's The Pollcast, and they did discuss this meeting on the latest episode, and they talked a lot about beyond just the outputs, which isn't much. There was the what was happening, what was it like to actually watch these premiers interact. And of course, many eyes are on Doug Ford, and he didn't really use this chance to do much. It sounded like he was there as the guy who was freshest in his boots, who didn't actually know all his files, as you would kind of expect someone a couple weeks into the job. And he just mostly sat back and listened.
I think Ford could be reasonably expected to know less than the average incoming premier on some of these files.
Yeah, but I think the surprise is that he wasn't speaking without knowing. He was just avoiding interviews, going, yeah, actively turning down interviews, sitting back and listening and not trying to push his weight around or just make demands known. Maybe next year, once he's gotten some momentum going. But and then the other obvious thing that I saw social media point out a bunch is just how homogenous the premier's meeting has gotten, as it's dwindled from about 50% almost.
It was 50% women, at one point.
To 1 in 13, which is pretty rough. And considering next year it could be zero, what happened, Canada?
Well, I'm sure a bunch of the people pointed it out, and in fact, voted against the re-electing the women premier we had in this province.
It's a left and right thing. The problem is, across Canada, people just aren't good at re-electing women, whether they're on the left or the right. Kathleen Wynne just lost. Rachel Notley might lose, probably, if we assume she loses.
Yeah, there's certainly been a trend that parties tend to pick women when they're in power and really unpopular, and the current premier or prime minister decides to leave early.
The Alberta NDP might be the one exception in that they just won as a fluke, but and it's not like they picked her because they were going down. They just didn't have anyone else because it was a caucus of two. But I think there's a larger issue there, and it's not really a conservative or liberal or socialist thing. It's a, like you're saying, are people just giving the dead weight to the women? We'll find out if Rachel Notley wins re-election. And I don't think there are any women who are likely to win in Quebec.
Quebec, no.
Unless Quebec Solidaire wins, but I don't know who their leader is even. And they're not winning.
Yeah, they're not winning. Yeah, I have no idea who their leader is.
So the next meeting is in Saskatchewan, where new Saskatchewan Party Premier Scott Moe gets to host the rest of the premiers. Is this meeting still worth it?
Maybe. I've always been kind of a little skeptical of these. Just get every single leader in a room and try and hash stuff out. I mean, there's definitely some times where it leads to value, but a lot of the time it's everybody shows up for a weekend, talks a bunch, you get a communique at the end that kind of highlights a few bullet points, but not a huge amount of substantive progress is made. It's probably a good thing for the various leaders to actually get some, face-to-face time and improve their relationships a bit. But it's policy-wise, you tend not to see a huge amount come out of these.
Yeah, the Canada where there isn't a premier's meeting and the Canada where there is are probably pretty close. Maybe this cooled the firestorm between Alberta and BC a tiny bit and allowed them to move forward on Greyhound services and things like that. But feel like that could have been done by phone calls between mid-level staffers.
Yeah, and with the Greyhound, for example, it's basically repeating what all the premiers have said, which is, hey, Ottawa, you should probably throw some money our way so we can do this thing with Greyhound here. And that's not much different than, what would have happened if they hadn't actually all gotten together.
Well, I think the best thing you can say about any of these meetings is nothing went wrong. Well, not a lot may have gone very well. No one made a fool of themselves that got out into the media. No one blundered their way through Doug Ford. No one made new enemies, John Horgan. So all in all, I guess it's a success. Yeah.
Yeah.
We'll have to see next year how it goes.
And when the next time the First Minister's Conference when Trudeau shows up to get asked for a bunch of money. Moving on to segment two. The gun debate. Unfortunately, this past week, there was a shooting in Toronto. And as a result, there's been a renewed interest in discussing firearms in Canada and what our approach to gun control is.
It was actually interesting to see both the Globe and Mail and the Star. And I guess if you had to guess which two newspapers would write this editorial, it would be those two. But both of their editorial boards took the Time to Rethink Our Gun Laws approach. And the Star, of course, pinned it all on Harper. And
yeah, the Star would have run that editorial without with or without a shooting.
It prompts it. They might have had a different thing to complain about otherwise, but, you know, they didn't decide their policy based on the shooting. And I think one of the things that's always frustrating, and I almost didn't want to talk about this week until I actually started looking at what the stories were, because anytime you have a major event or crisis or situation and people immediately start throwing policy recommendations around, they're probably bad.
Yeah, and like I think it's really worth pausing here and reflecting on the fact that Canada is not the U.S., and the U.S. really should, after every mass shooting, take a hard look and say, maybe we should change stuff, whereas Canada's discussion around it isn't quite as dysfunctional, and I think a more measured approach is reasonable here.
And it's fun watching progressives throw out arguments, and we'll get into the actual arguments in a minute, but in this kind of situation, because one of the things we'd like to complain about are reactionary arguments, and the definition of a reactionary is doing it into reaction to something. And here you have a terrible tragedy and you're reacting kind of knee-jerkly, going, we need to do this, this, and this. And it's like, it's been a couple of days now, so we're starting to maybe give some nuance to this. And, you know, as I read it, there are some things being pointed out that the liberals aren't actually considering new policies in response to this shooting. They were actually considering and thinking through policies and reaction, but over a longer period, so it's a little bit less knee-jerk. From the last bad shooting, which was January 2017, or last major bad shooting, the Quebec mosque shooting. And, you know, taking a year and a half to think through policies feels a little less knee-jerky, so that's promising, at least. But what are they trying to do?
Yeah, so they have Bill C-71 in the works, which I'll refer you back to a previous episode we did where we talked about it when it was first announced, and we'll throw the link in the show notes for that. The short version is it basically expands background checks to the person's entire life rather than a given period, as well as it would change some of the rules around transporting firearms and some other tweets like that. And we talked about it at the time. There are some things that made sense and some that don't.
Some of them are largely just like undoing Harper changes because Harper did them rather than because they're a good idea.
Yeah, like the transport authorization for restricted firearms. There isn't a huge amount of good reason why it should be separate from the restricted firearms license rather than one piece of paper, which is basically what Harper did, is combine the two.
But on the background checks thing, one thing that's come out in the editorials this week is, despite the proposed changes and the system we have right now, it turns out you can just lie on your background, on at least the mental health section for your gun license. And this is actually what people are pointing out happened in Alexander Bissonnette's case in the Quebec mosque shooting, is he just didn't tell the gun registry people that he had mental health issues in his past, which might have precluded him from buying the gun he used to walk into that mosque with.
Yeah, you do have to put down references on the application, as well as list any past partners. It's on there, and I'm not sure how thoroughly those are followed up on, but yeah, if those references didn't mention it, or there wasn't the right follow-up, you know, it's definitely plausible stuff could slip through.
And there's inevitably going to be bureaucratic issues and civil liberties issues if you're asking for
medical histories
all
and
of this, yeah, and too invasively. But at the same time, you don't have a right to a firearm in this country, so I kind of don't shed too many tears, as long as we're not just making paperwork for the sake of paperwork.
Yeah, and by and large, our licensing system works pretty well in the country.
But the licensing system wasn't actually what was at play in this week's shooting, because as the National Post reported, the gun was actually an illegally obtained gun, so a license and registry wouldn't have mattered at all.
Yeah, a bunch of media outlets picked up on this and ran stories on it, and the gun used in the Toronto shooting was illegally imported from the U.S., and that's actually a very common source of illegal firearms. In fact, between 50 to 75%, depending on the year in question, that number of guns used in crimes are sourced illegally from the U.S. So any serious gun control efforts, and by that I mean actual efforts that will reduce crime rather than limit access to legal firearms, really has to tackle the U.S. border more so than, or at least as strongly as, anything to do with how you can legally purchase and possess a firearm in this country.
And it's quite a nuanced and complicated discussion, as you're alluding to. The stats I saw suggested, even, you know, 5-10 years ago, it was on the higher end, that 70-80% of the illegally obtained firearms in Canada came from the States, whereas it's almost become more like 50% today. And I don't know for sure whether that's just the total number of illegal firearms has remained same and the proportion has changed, or if there's been a wild increase in Canadian illegally obtained firearms, or like a drop off of US ones, or some mix. There does seem to have been a large increase in legally obtained Canadian handguns and firearms following some of the changes over the past 15 years, which might suggest that Canadians are getting legal firearms and then they are becoming illegal when they sell them or just transfer them to the black market or otherwise. And that might be part of the issue. It's something that definitely needs a lot more thought and looking at. The fact we've gone from 660,000 handguns to 840,000 in 3 years seems like a lot.
Essentially a bigger interest than I would have predicted.
Yeah, that's a lot of handguns in just 3 years. That one I think came from the Globe and Mail's editorial, but that doesn't mean I'm in support of just like quick, rash policies. But I think the point overall that I think we'll agree on is that overall crime is dropping and we don't want to take big drastic measures that needlessly complicate people's lives and don't actually do anything. But I think there are some signs here that guns are becoming slightly more prevalent in Canada.
Yeah, and I think the one thing that both gun owners and gun control advocates would say is the system needs an overhaul, because there's a lot of weird little quirks, and I don't think they'd agree on which way they need to be overhauled, but overall I think the system strikes a good balance. The actual details, once you look into it, are kind of a little bizarre, and like how different firearms are classified and everything, like, makes absolutely no sense from any sort of technical standpoint. But from a, you have three classes of firearms with various levels of restriction on them, you need to go through certain steps to acquire them, like, that makes a reasonable amount of sense. And, you know, if we're not just going to ban guns, I think the system we've got works fairly well, but needs a lot of the details to have minor tweaks done.
Well, it's funny you say ban guns, because unlike in the US, one thing Canadian politicians will actually say and not be afraid of losing their job is just that. You had Toronto Mayor John Tory being like, why does anyone even need a handgun? You had Toronto MP Adam Vaughan basically saying, I don't own a gun. I don't know anyone who goes again. Why would anyone want a gun? Well, I guess maybe some farmers would. Maybe we can have a two-tiered legal system where the rural areas can have one law and cities can have another. But my favorite part of his quote is just how no one is using handguns to cull the raccoon population in Toronto, which reminds me of an anecdote of when I went to school in Airdrie in southern Alberta, just outside Calgary, and they weren't shooting gophers with handguns. That's inefficient. They were filling gopher holes in the city limits with propane or methane or some kind of explosive gas and lighting it and blowing up gopher holes, because every, you know, few second or every few minutes you'd hear this like shotgun level blast, right? This is like almost next to residential zones, but they're just killing gophers by the dozen. I don't know.
Alberta's an interesting place.
Yeah, fun times. So maybe they don't do that kind of thing in the big city, but where I'm from, that was a useful derail. Anyway, gun debate. We should probably get someone who actually knows the policy on at some point in like and has strong opinions on it.
Yeah, I have a decent sense of the policy, but I just don't have particularly strong opinions on it. So I want someone to actually rant about it. We could get someone on.
Yeah. If that's you, dear listener, hit us up at PoliticosPod.
Yeah, the only other thing I'll add to this is, well, I think we can definitely have a healthier conversation about guns in this country. We're it's not always the best. And Matt Gurney actually had a good Twitter rant about the tendency for some journalists and policymakers to wear their ignorance around firearms as a badge of honor and how it's really not a good thing. And you wouldn't see that as a good thing anywhere else in journalism or politics. So yeah, our conversations in this country are better than the US, but we really shouldn't always just look to the US as the way we view stuff like this.
Oh no, we should really. Yeah, but like, would do a lot better as a country if we stopped looking to the US as like a policy comparison.
Yeah, for everything, like healthcare, like everything.
I'm trying to think of one thing where they do it better, but it reminds, talking about journalist ignorance on guns, it almost reminds me of like how they tend to treat cannabis, where, you know, you get the novelty spliff photo attached to every story. At least we don't quite do that with guns. We don't have like, I mean, there are like random pictures of like, here's a pile of ammo, stock photography. And those are kind of bad, but you don't have novelty Tommy guns held by gangsters and being like, this is the photo of guns in Canada today. But
yeah, and
Canadian journalism
badly misidentify it. It'd be like a handgun and they call it an assault rifle or something ridiculous like that.
But yeah, of course, our thoughts do go out to the victims of the shooting, their families, and everyone else. And I'm also just like disgusted at the number and speed that conspiracy theories are coming out these days. I guess that's the era we live in.
Yeah, Ezra Levant was quick to start the conspiracy bullshit on this one and hasn't gone away, unfortunately.
He just never goes away.
No.
Moving on to quick takes, while we're in Ontario, Doug Ford has announced a rather bizarre change to how Toronto will be electing councillors this fall. I mean, actually, nominations close tomorrow.
Yeah, so Toronto's also having a municipal election coming up, and at literally the last minute, basically, the new premier decided, you know what? Toronto really just has too many councillors, so I'm just going to slash that and a whole bunch of other positions the day before nominations close.
It went from something like 57 to 24?
Yeah, 47 to 25, and like Toronto's a big city, so I get why they have a big council. Although, I haven't watched some of the local ones here. Just waiting for 10 people to, plus a mayor to speak is painful enough. I can't imagine sitting through 47 of them, but still, like, that's not the sort of thing you just kind of do on a whim.
There's rumors this is motivated, and people will figure out motivations maybe eventually, but the rumors and initial hot takes are it's entirely driven by spite.
I could see that, especially the removal of some of the regional chair positions, particularly the one in Peel, for example, which a one Patrick Brown is being looking to contest. That being Ford's predecessor as leader of the PC party there. So, and the rumors had it that Ford was looking to try and find someone to be a strong candidate to run against Brown. So he may have just decided it's easier just not to have the election than see his predecessor do well.
Yeah, that's not a good precedent.
No.
Especially like a month into your premiership to start realizing, hey, if we just don't have elections, I can have more power longer.
Yeah, although the difference here is that cities in Canada are just outgrowths of the province and basically exist as, you know, on the provincial's whim, more province's whim, more or less, because they really have no constitutional presence at all. They're just things the province creates and delegates authority to.
Yeah, and that's true across the country, but I don't know, I just almost like had assumed there would have been some statutory mechanism to slow down changing the size and composition of councils, but I guess it's just like
it might actually,
it's a regulatory thing.
Yeah, I'm actually not sure. It might have to go. They might actually have to pass a law on this, in which case you get into some really weird due process questions when like people have gotten nominated, and then you get rid of the place they're nominated in. This seems like a mess of an idea,
and a great way to get sued.
Yeah. So the Star wrote the story on this one, and Doug Ford's apparently going to give a press conference tomorrow, Friday morning, about this. So by the time you're listening, you might actually have a better idea what the hell's going on than we do. But yeah, Ontario seems to have looked south and decided, you know, two can play at that game. Just being kind of a little off kilter and not really having a whole lot of respect for institutions.
Well, looking south, it could actually be, ironically, Donald Trump, who is the savior of the environmentalist dream of killing the Trans Mountain Pipeline.
This puts some people in a weird position where, like, yeah, okay, so you're nationalizing big bit of energy infrastructure, but it's a, which we liked, but it's a pipeline, which we don't, but it might be blocked, which we liked, but by Donald Trump that we don't, and the whole thing is just one hell of a story.
So to step back and fill in the details, essentially, part of the purchase agreement for the Trans Mountain Pipeline from Kinder Morgan to Government of Canada includes, like, less than 100 kilometers of pipe that goes from, like, White Rock into the state.
Abbotsford. There's a spur line coming from Abbotsford down to the refineries in the, like, Puget Seattle Sound area.
Yeah.
I think might be Bellingham. Oh, Puget Sound area.
It's a very short segment of pipe, essentially, that protrudes into the U.S. And because of that, the U.S. actually has to do a security review, a national security review of the purchase to make sure they figure there's nothing untoward.
Yeah, because there's, you know, it's a big honking chunk of energy infrastructure crossed on the border. Like, it's the sort of thing security reviews are there for. But there's a little concern over whether or not Donald Trump might take a politically motivated tact when it comes to approving this.
So the review runs through a relatively nonpartisan board, as far as I understand it, that will make a recommendation probably to approve the sale without any issue.
I can't see them approving against or recommend against it.
They hand that on Trump's desk, and then Trump can go and do what he does and not read it and just decide, hey, I'm in a trade war with Canada. Why would I let them do this when they still have supply management or they still want to
not pay tariffs on auto parts or something stupid.
And it gives him a lever. So Donald Trump could spontaneously decide Trans Mountain sale can't proceed. And that puts a lot of weird questions at the federal government's door. I guess we've all kind of, they just assumed this would go through because that's normal politics, but we don't live in normal politics anymore.
Yeah, and it seems odd that a 1,300 kilometer plus pipeline is going to get derailed because of a little spur that goes down to Anacortes. But that's apparently what might happen.
I guess we'll have to keep our eye on that. Maybe nothing will happen and the story will just disappear, but I thought it was really funny.
Well, speaking of big controversial energy infrastructure projects, Site C's back in the news as the Westmoreland First Nations are once again taking the project to court to seek an injunction to stop construction.
So the news this week is the hearings have begun for the whether the injunction will happen. And so this is like the pre-trial. Is there enough of a good argument by the First Nation that they weren't properly consulted, that we should stop construction because that might cause irreparable harm? I was actually just reading about injunctive relief on a couple other cases I'm working on, but it'll be interesting to see. This has, on BC Hydro's side, they're bragging about how they've, you know, won 14 successive cases on Site C and not lost once. On the other hand, a lot of people are pitching this as like one of the strongest arguments against it, because these are the people whose land is going to get flooded. And in terms of irreparable harm, your land getting flooded is pretty real and tangible. Now, whether they meet the other bars of the test remain to be seen, but that's what they're arguing this week. And I suspect it'll probably get us a result pretty quickly, because courts tend to rule on preliminary injunctions pretty quick because there are urgent issues at play, like people's land getting flooded or not. I guess the irony of this case is now, after talking about UNDRIP and working on reconciliation, the BC government has to be there going, yeah, we're totally fine flooding these First Nations land, even when they say they don't haven't given consent because the previous government consulted enough. The frustrating job of being government, I guess.
Mm-hmm. And inheriting big policy files. Yeah, so this is part of a bunch of ongoing cases, and including one that, just reading here, seeking damages for the past dams that have been built. And I think we'll, yeah, definitely see the injunction question resolved before those other ones. But yeah, I mean, the BC Hydro's track record on the legal front's been pretty good so far. So the smart money's on probably BC Hydro is going to prevail and it'll go ahead, but yeah, you know, it's not an open shut case.
It only takes one successful lawsuit to shut the project down, so maybe this is that one. I don't know. I don't really have strong feelings on Site C, even though I feel like I should. But the other thing that could spell bad news for the BCNDP, and this is purely because of history, not because of anything that's looking like it could be bad, but BC Ferries has put up an RFEOI, a request
for expression of interest,
for five new ferries. They basically have said they've been talking about the need to update and modernize the fleet and replace some of the really old boats we're running.
Yeah, and we're going to be looking to buy a bunch of boats. And the headline is BC and Canadian shipyards are encouraged to submit these. But if you actually read a few sentences down, those are international shipyards too. So, I mean, I guess it's good work for the economically protectionist route, although the communications are certainly trying to hint it is in fact going that way.
Yeah, it was weird to see that headline versus the actual text of it, considering, as far as I could see, nothing in it suggested a BC shipyard will be prioritized other than
the headline, like, basically.
Yeah, the headline.
Like, yeah.
I mean, there was a different story on the BC government. I was scrolling through their news releases and they're talking about a possible wet dock in Port Alberni, but I can't see that being big enough or up.
Port Alberni? That's
Really?
Why would you take the ferry around out of the protected sailor's sea and into?
Oh, no. Sorry. They're planning a new shipyard for Port Alberni, which also
still
not a great idea.
No
offense to our Port Alberni listener.
I have family there, but like, it's not the place you want to be put in a shipyard. That's a really weird. Huh. I'm going to have to look at that
once we're finished.
But yeah, so the news release is titled BC Ferries and Churches, BC and Canadian Shipyards to respond to request for expression of interest to build five vessels. And then in the second sentence of the news release, it is competitive bidding process is open to local, national, and international shipyards. So not exactly as clear as it could be.
The risk here for the BCNDP is that they're still have fast ferries hanging around their neck, but at least this process seems to have started before them. And
yeah, in fact, I don't think this is going to be that problematic unless they end up going for the economically protectionist route and overpay to have a local shipyard build it, because some of the ferries to be built are Salish class vessels, which astute BC ferry watchers, which I'm sure we have several in the audience, well, no, we are already sailing those vessels, and turns out we're just going to be providing the plans and asking the shipyard to build to those. So this isn't, you know, some brand new untested idea of let's make ferries faster. This is a, hey, this is a design we have. We want more of them. Who can build it for us?
Well, this isn't the 90s. We've learned not to build them faster. It's 2018. We want
cleaner.
So the other class is the island class that are going to be electric hybrid propulsion, which have batteries, and they will reduce our carbon emissions using clean tech. And I'm sure that will be totally fine.
That's actually the other area where, like, this is still new technology. Cost overruns are more of a concern there.
Like, I'm in favor of hybrid ferries. That just sounds cool, but,
yeah, you know, the charging cycle versus the time in port. Like, yeah, it's the sort of thing I'd have to look into on the technical side, but I could see not being particularly feasible for long trips.
But this will be the ongoing story of the rest of the year. It probably won't be too controversial, but the contract should be awarded by the end of the year, according to BC Ferries. So we'll keep our eye. Maybe it will end up becoming a big story because the NDP suddenly decides that it needs to fall under a community benefit agreement and be built in Port Alberni. And
okay, I'm really going to look that up because that seems just weird and bizarre. But yeah, I think C-SPAN is probably going to be a more likely candidate, although they're busy with our national shipbuilding strategy at the moment. Well, the other news this week is the high-speed rail study that we'd mentioned several months ago, back when the Washington governor was up here for a state visit. They agreed to that, and it's actually been finalized. We will be contributing to $1.5 million study to, well, study high-speed rail in the Cascadia region.
It's a step closer. I like everyone's in favor of the idea of a 1 hour trip between Vancouver and Seattle, I think.
Yeah.
Of course, the train could cost $20 to $40 billion. So
turns out tracks are expensive, especially when you have to secure a bunch of right-of-ways that are very limited in terms of the geometry, because if you take corners too fast at high speeds, bad things happen.
Let's just build it underground or over the water.
That's also expensive.
Yeah, it turns out.
Yeah.
Hyperloop above ground. Also expensive and unproven, as we just talked about.
Unproven, yes. But who knows, maybe Elon Musk will offer us cheap tunnels. But so yeah, it's us, the US government, Microsoft, made a study in this, and you know, it's definitely potential. And there's a regionally local group that started up to advocate for this. They actually had an event a couple months back here in Vancouver, which I went to, which is interesting. Decent turnout to it. They had a decent number of kind of business and civic leaders there. So yeah, I think it's the thing that has support.
There's no timeline on this study. And if once the study's done, studies can sometimes be done and then sat on shelves.
Yeah,
they have.
Rick Mercer did a skit at one point about Canada's superb high-speed rail study industry, because we apparently produce a lot of high-speed rail studies.
I think Washington has actually hired the contractor to start doing it.
WSP has been awarded the contract for this.
The only other thing is, it's kind of interesting that Microsoft chipped in money for this. Like,
well, they have bigger operations both here and in Redmond, so it made sense.
I mean, so does Amazon, and so do lots of different, well, Amazon's further south, but I don't know. It's a random corporate sponsor to kind of chip in a couple $100,000, but I guess it's just a donation for them.
Yeah, and honestly, outside of the tourism industry, they're one of the people I would pick to have them, you know, or make the most sense for them to contribute to it.
So hopefully we'll hear results of a high-speed rail study soon, or at least a consultation process, and we'll send links to that.
Yeah, well, this is the engineering study on it. There'll definitely be a consultation one, and it's got to be like 11 years ago now. The Washington DOT did a study on this as well, and that was mostly, I think, upgrading the existing lines, whereas this one would be a new right away. But yeah, there's a lot that can. I think there's a lot of interest in the region on this one, and yeah, high speed rail from here to Portland wouldn't be the worst thing ever.
Well, moving on, Insights West has a new poll out, finding that the BCNDP are generally being seen to be doing a pretty all right job, except on housing. The top line numbers are that if there were an election tomorrow, the NDP would score 37% of the vote, the Liberals 32%, the Greens 17%, and a smattering of votes would go to whatever makes up 100% there. John Horgan's personal approval has dropped 6 points, down to 47%. A disapproval rising to 40%, so his net approval is +7. He's still probably one of the most popular premiers in Canada, which tells you how much we love our premiers. The other leaders in the province, Andrew Weaver has about 37%, and Andrew Wilkinson about 24%. Most interesting number in here, though, is that 54% of British Columbians say the NDP are doing a bad job on housing affordability, and just 24% think they're actually doing a good job. I guess if you look around and go, can I afford a house? No, bad job. That's reasonable. But what else do they want them to do? Crash the market?
there's a segment that would want that. But part of that is they've been in power for about a year now, but the actual policy bills that are coming through are just making their way through the legislature now and end of the spring session. So the actual effects haven't really been felt yet. Some of the stuff that say delegate a certain amount of authority to the municipalities, they haven't been exactly quick to pick up on, like the rental only zoning.
Who only Burnaby has just started to pick up on?
Yeah, mostly because they're feeling an incredible amount of heat for their policies around their rentals, but that's more territory for your Canby Report show, which listeners are encouraged to listen to for all your local politics takes.
On the poll, though, the Liberals can't be looking at this very positively. Like, Andrew Wilkinson's low approval, I think, is largely just a who kind of result, but the fact that people aren't super excited about most of the policies, like things their NDP are scoring best at are environment and education, which they will generally do well on because they're the NDP and people just hear that and assume they will do well on those, and First Nations issues. But I think people's front of mind issues are still housing affordability in the economy. And I guess the only reason the Liberals aren't doing better is they don't have anything better to pitch yet.
Yeah, and that's been part of the problem with Andrew Wilkinson. Like, during the leadership campaign, he talked a lot about the problem with the 30,000-foot view the Liberals had and how nobody really cared about a AAA credit rating when housing was unaffordable. But that Andrew Wilkinson hasn't been very effective at translating that into substantive critiques of the NDP.
Oh, no, now he's the defender of the mansion owner.
Yeah, and that, as I was just about to get to, is instead he's kind of gone with, you know, this is class warfare angle and everything. It's just...
He went from 30,000 feet to 40,000 feet.
Yes.
That was the problem. He went the wrong way. He tried to get further from the ground.
The thing is, it's just not resonating with people at all. And, you know, there are options out there to actually take a different tact on it, but... He hasn't so far, and I think that's hurting him. And, you know, maybe it plays well with the base. I mean, the partisan BC Liberals I know seem to like him, but, like, I haven't gotten a great sense from people outside of that circle that that's really been the case.
The one thing I think they have more space to grow on and strengthen on, the problem is it's mostly in the interior where they're already pretty popular, but is on energy files like Trans Mountain, where... The NDP isn't actually performing well in these polls. Like, they tend to find, like, increasing support for the pipeline and decreasing support for, like, strident opposition. But the NDP are in government and tied to the Greens, so are strident about this issue, so...
And, like, if they want to, like, talk about things they're strong about, like the economy and whatnot... and get at the housing affordability, the transportation issue. There's ways you can structure it around, like, you know, we need to do more building and that'll help the economy. And we'll, you know, we're going to grow our way out of this housing affordability. Like, you can pitch that and at least be a way that would, I think, connect better than don't tax the mansion owners, which if you're not a mansion owner, it really isn't going to do a huge amount for you.
Like, part of this is... opposition parties are always at a disadvantage of having to play follow rather than lead because they have to respond to what the government does. And if they say, here's our new policy proposal, people will be like, yeah, so what? You're not in government. And the NDP can immediately turn around and actually do something and people will pay attention because it actually affects people's lives. So when we get to the next election, things might change. The Liberals might pick up steam with the proportional representation referendum because they're throwing a lot of eggs in that basket to oppose that. So, you know, it's still early days for Andrew Wilkinson, although it does look like the sheen is coming off John Horgan a little bit. He's dropped from his honeymoon bump of new premier, but still in a good zone to keep leading effectively. But the final thing I wanted to mention, as we are starting to sweat to death in this Vancouver condo in the middle of a heat wave, is the BC government had one more press release that I just found both fantastic and disappointing at the same time, and that it's the government needs to remind people not to fly your drones into forest fires. Turns out that is a thing people have done, which actually impedes firefighters' ability to put out forest fires because they have to shut down their operations and, like, catch who's flying the drone, give them a ticket. And then
can't
restart.
Fly the aircraft that are there to put out the fires over the fires when you have drones occupying the airspace instead.
So the actual rules, and these are federal aviation rules, are there is a restricted airspace of 5 nautical miles around a forest fire and to an altitude of 3,000 feet above ground level, which if you're flying a drone anywhere near there, it will be in that lower altitude zone. If you do that, you could be fined up to $25,000 or jailed for 18 months. So don't do it. And you could also contravene the Provincial Wildfire Act for interference, which could get you another $1,150 ticket. And if you're convicted, you could actually face a fine of $100,000 and an imprisonment of over a year. So really, all kinds of reasons. Don't fly your drones in fires because people are trying to do their jobs and put this province out. And with climate change, we're going to be on fire for the rest of time. So don't fly your drones in fires. I don't know if there's anything else to say.
There shouldn't have to be, but somehow there is. I'm British Columbia, Victoria's my capital, Canada.
Cosmos province touching the Pacific coast. And I have lots of mountain ranges. Whistler Mountain is my most famous. If you're looking to ski or snowboard, I have lots of these places.
Well, I want to close with one quick Best of BC Poly for this week. We had a nomination for a new Twitter account that's out there, at BC Ledge Style. And this is on Twitter and Instagram. And this is someone who is trying to highlight the fashion of the BC legislature. But it seems like mostly it's interns and other sort of staffers wandering around asking people, oh, why'd you pick that dress? Those are some dapper shoes. If you're into fashion and style, and I'm not really, if you've ever seen the kind of things I wear around, it's a nice Instagram, and it hopefully will push BC political followers to step up a notch. A shout out to at NYAVVR for suggesting that Twitter account to follow. If you want to follow more good style, go to twitter.com/BCLegStyle.
And that has been Politicoast. Find links to stories we mentioned in the show notes at politicoast.ca. Make sure to subscribe or listen to podcasts and follow us on Facebook and Twitter at politicoastpod. Leave us a review and let us know what you think. Support the show and get early access to our interviews at patreon.com/politicoast. If you have any ideas for the show, feel free to send them to us. Thanks for listening.